Well, good morning. My name is Armand Peschard. I'm a senior associate here at CSIS in the Americas program. And I'd like to acknowledge Peter DeShazo, who's sitting in the back, the director of the Americas program. We both are delighted to be hosting this morning's event on an issue that I think is still of utmost importance, not just for Mexico, but for the U.S., and that is Mexico's most recent electoral reform. I guess we would have had a much bigger audience before a Fox victory and perhaps before a Calderon victory, but needless to say, it's still a vitally important issue, I think, in Mexico, and it should be for the United States as well. I'm delighted to have here with us three individuals with, I think, different perspectives. For all of you who follow Mexico's electoral democracy, you all know that Mexico has undergone a series of electoral reforms dating back to the 40s, 1977, 1991, 1996. And usually electoral reforms follow a contested election, federal election, that creates the conditions for there to be electoral reform in Mexico. But unlike the previous reforms, this reform is actually the first electoral reform that takes place under a truly democratic Mexico, I would say. And it's the first electoral reform where you have, I think, as healthy a debate as we've seen, I think, in especially relative to previous electoral reforms. Previous electoral reforms, I would say, were solely backroom deals. This electoral reform really, I think, had a healthy phase of public debate, and obviously there were different perspectives concerning the reform. And I think that with the three distinguished guests that we have here, I think we do justice to having different perspectives represented here at this event. So I'm delighted. Some see it favorably, some see it negatively, and I guess that will come out in the course of the event. You all have their bios, so I'll be very brief in terms of introducing them. And I'm going to go actually in the order in which they're going to be presenting. We'll start off with Sergio Sarmiento. And Sergio, I know I've introduced you before as Sergio Sarmiento Unplugged, because we all know Sergio Sarmiento from his multiple electronic persona, whether it's with TV Azteca, whether it's with, is it Radio Centro? And a prolific writer, also as a columnist with the Reforma newspaper. Interestingly enough, I consider, and many of you, I think, consider Sergio to be someone who shapes public opinion in Mexico. And I've told Sergio that he too shapes public opinion here in Washington among those that follow Mexico. So we're delighted to have Sergio here. And one of the reasons why he is so successful, I think, is because he is very objective in his analysis. Following Sergio, we're going to have Jeffrey Weldon. By the way, Sergio is an adjunct fellow here at CSIS, and so is Jeff. Jeffrey is the chair of the political science department at the ITAM, and he's the director of the undergraduate program there in political science. He's probably one of Mexico's foremost experts, I think, on the Mexican Congress, and I'm delighted that Jeff, that you're here again with us today. And then last, but by no means least, is another good friend, Raul Avila, who is someone who is a legal scholar of electoral law. But he's someone who actually not only has studied Mexican electoral democracy, but has actually lived it, having recently been defeated in a mayoral race. I know I hate to raise it again and remind you of it, but who was recently defeated in a mayoral race in his home state of Oaxaca. Not a complex state whatsoever. But as you can see, he's very much involved in electoral law. He's the only lawyer of the three, and I'm also delighted that he's not charging us by the hour today. And it doesn't say here in his bio, but he also spent several years at the Federal Electoral Tribunal overseeing the International Affairs Department of the Federal Electoral Tribunal. So he really knows the adjudication phase of electoral law very intimately, and will be able to provide us an interesting perspective. He was, I think, an advisor in the drafting of the reform. And so, like I said, I'm delighted that we have the different perspectives represented here at the table. And it'll be interesting to see what you all walk away thinking of the reform after having heard their perspectives. So with that, Sergio, I'll... I forgot to say one thing. And we're delighted and grateful to the Tinker Foundation. This is the last deliverable of a generous grant that we had from the Tinker Foundation. And the Tinker Foundation has been committed to promoting electoral democracy in Mexico. And so, having said that, Sergio.
Thank you. Armand, I do want to thank Armand Pechard. He's been a colleague of mine for many, many years, and also a good friend. So thank you for thinking of me, Peter Chase. So thank you for having me here again. I had almost forgotten that I'm an adjunct fellow of the CSIS. It's a pleasure to be back home again, and of course to the Tinker Foundation that has made this this possible. There's one thing I want to say. I work for various media, and very often they have very different points of view. Reforma, the newspaper, TV Azteca, Grupo Radio Centro. So I do want to say that my positions, my opinions are my own. They do not represent the position of any of the companies that I work for. Electoral reform was not among the highest demands of Mexico in 2007 with the new administration. There were many things Mexicans wanted, but if you had public opinion polls, electoral reform was not included among the 10 or 20 top demands of the population. And one of the reasons is because we've had quite a number of electoral reforms starting from 1977. Armand went back further to 1940, into the 1940s. But there was a good reason why we started a cycle of electoral reforms in 1977. 1976 was the last time we had a president elected with 100% of the vote. José López Portillo in 1976 was elected president of Mexico, and he received exactly 100% of the vote. He didn't get less than that. He didn't get more either, which is, I think, was a good thing to have. But the point is that he became president with 100% of the vote, and he was concerned about it. It was very difficult to show to the world that Mexico was different from the Soviet Union or from different from Cuba if we had a president that was elected with 100% of the vote. That's why he asked his Secretario de Gobernación, his Minister of the Interior, Jesús Reyes Heroles, Don Jesús Reyes Heroles, not the present one, but the father, to start working on an electoral reform that led to the legalization of opposition parties and began to build the present system that we have right now. But we didn't have one or two electoral reforms over this period. We had one reform in 1977, another one in 1986, another one in 1989, another one in 1992, another one in 1994, and finally the reform of 1996, which in my opinion was the fundamental reform. That was the reform that made it possible for the opposition to win the midterm parliamentary elections of 1997 and the presidential elections of the year 2000. For the first time, with the 1996 electoral reform, we had reasonably fair electoral rules that allowed an opposition party to actually win elections. And in my opinion, at that point, with the 1996 election, we had managed to create the rules that were necessary for a country like Mexico to have a true democracy, alternation of parties in power, and a reasonable way to rule ourselves after a history in which we had never had alternation of parties in power. We had never had the peaceful handling of power to a president or a ruler coming from the opposition in the history of Mexico, not since Aztec times or colonial times. We had never had that. In 2006, with these rules, we had the closest election in history. It was an election in which one candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, was 10 points ahead of in public opinion polls in January or February. He made a number of mistakes. The election got to be very, very close. And in the end, Felipe Calderón, candidate of the National Action Party, won the election with less than 1% of the difference. In fact, it was just about half a percentage point of difference. The thing that that changed what would have otherwise been a great election was the fact that the losing candidate refused to concede. This is not new in Mexico. In about 95% of the cases in Mexico, the losing candidate refuses to concede. In Mexico, you don't lose an election. In Mexico, it's always taking away from you. There's always a plot, there's fraud, there's whatever you want. But the fact is that in 95 or more percent of the cases, losing candidates refuse to concede in Mexico. That's not the fault of the electoral legislation. That's the fault of the candidates. In fact, what we had, we have begun to see some cases in which candidates do concede. I do have to point out that even though Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who was number two in the election, refused to concede, Roberto Madrazo, for example, who was number three, who was a member of the party that used to get all the elections and a member of the party that got 100% of the vote in 1976, did concede the result of the election. We have many safeguards in our electoral legislation, and they were put into practice in the 2006 election. We had a Federal Electoral Institute that took notice of all of the complaints by the losing candidate, looked at them, decided that the election had been won fairly. Then there was an electoral court that considered all of the complaints and finally decided that even though the election was not perfect, just as there are no perfect elections anywhere in the world, the electoral tribunal, the electoral court, decided that the elections had been within the law, and thus the electoral court granted the certificate of majority, the certificate of election to Felipe Calderón, who then became president of Mexico. Most observers, most objective observers, most nonpartisan observers accepted the validity of the election of 2006. When Felipe Calderón became president, the first concern of people in Mexico was whether he was going to be able to rule at all. There was a threat by the PRD, the leftist party, and Andrés Manuel López Obrador that they wouldn't allow Felipe Calderón to swear office. And it isn't clear, according to our constitution, what happens if the president doesn't swear office. There are reasons to believe that he might not be legally the president of Mexico. Some people claim that that's not true, but the point is that the PRD did everything possible, including using physical resistance, to try to prevent the swearing of office. But if you if you actually run public opinion polls, and there are a number of public opinion polls that showed us that the main concerns of the people in Mexico at the time of the change of administration were, first of all, law and order. People in Mexico feel that crime has gotten totally out of hand, so that was the main concern of people in Mexico. Number two was employment. And number three, the development of the economy in general. Those were the three main issues in Mexico at the time of the change of administration. What did the political elite do in the face of these concerns? Well, they proceeded to promote a so-called reform of the state. The term reform of the state is a term invented by Manlio Fabio Beltrones, who's the coordinator of the senators of the Revolutionary Institutional Party, the PRI. And he felt that what the country really needed was an electoral reform, or reform of the state, which was supposed to include a lot of things, but eventually included only an electoral reform. What did Manlio Fabio Beltrones wanted? Why was this reform so important for him? Maybe we should point out that he is a contender for the presidential elections of 2012. He wants to run for president, and he felt that the rules of the game were not precisely the rules of the game that would have helped him to become president. The electoral reform, I'm one analyst who's always said that we do need some additional electoral reforms. I do believe that we have a pretty decent legislation right now, but there are certain things that might have to change. But the new electoral reform did not include any of the things that were important for an electoral reform in Mexico. For example, we did not get re-election of legislators. This is very important because our legislators get elected for 3-year periods, our deputies and our senators for 6 years. They have no chance of re-election, and the consequence is that there is no need for the legislators to have any kind of accountability. They don't need to go back to the people who elected them. They don't need to prove that they're doing something for the benefit of the people. They simply know they have to be loyal to the party, because the party will appoint them to the next public position they're going to have. And since they're basically life-term bureaucrats, they're only concerned with being able to get a new position after 3 years' time or after 6 years' time. So re-election of legislators, which many observers thought was one of the basic issues that had to be addressed by an electoral reform, was not included. We did not get the elimination of party list legislators. We have a number of legislators that do represent a constituency, and then we have a number of legislators that do not represent anything. They just represent the party. We have 300 deputies that are district deputies. They represent a certain district in the country, and then we have 200 deputies that represent no one but their party, and thus they're not accountable to the people. They're accountable only to the party leaders, and this of course generates a party-centered electoral and political system that is, in my opinion, very detrimental to the good health of democracy in Mexico. There was another issue that had to be addressed by a good electoral reform, which was transparency among political parties. We do have one of the accomplishments of the Vicente Fox administration. I must say that he didn't have very many, but one of the accomplishments of the Vicente Fox administration was a transparency law, a Freedom of Information Act, that in fact compels the government to release information about spending, the kind of information you can get from government in Mexico, in the United States, that weren't able to get in Mexico at any time. We are now able to get from the government, from the federal government in Mexico, through this Freedom of Information Act, la ley de transparencia. But political parties, even though they use public money, we have to remember that candidates or political parties in Mexico do not have to raise money. They do get public subsidy, and that's the money they use for the campaign. Even though they use public money, they're not subject to the transparency legislation in Mexico. So the three basic issues that any electoral reform had to include in Mexico were not included. re-election of legislators, elimination of party list legislators, and transparency for political parties. What did the new legislation include? Basically, the issues were this. First of all, to sack the electoral councillors. The councillors are the top decision-making group of people at the IFE, the Federal Electoral Institute. So they're the arbiters of the electoral process. Why was it important for these electoral councillors to be sacked? First of all, because Andrés Manuel López Obrador and the PRD demanded that as a way to prove that there had been an electoral fraud in 2006. So they needed revenge, and that was the reason why they wanted them to be sacked. And Manlio Fabio Beltrones, why did the PRI accept the position that the councillors had to be sacked? For a very simple and political reason. The group within the PRI that negotiated the appointment of these councillors was a group headed by Maestra Elba Esther Gordillo, the head of the teachers' union, who has always been an enemy of Manlio Fabio Beltrones. She has been kicked out of the PRI ever since, and Manlio Fabio Beltrones wanted to send a signal that he wanted his own councillors at the Federal Electoral Institute. So the reform included sacking of electoral councillors, getting given the parties and candidates free political advertising media time, and of course you know there is no free lunch in Mexico or in the States or anywhere. So basically, this was accomplished by confiscating television and radio time without indemnization from TV and from radio stations. And maybe you can tell me, well, television is such a highly concentrated market in Mexico that maybe this was just, maybe this was something that had to be done. But to begin with, I don't quite believe that in confiscation without indemnization in any case. But, for example, radio was punished as well. And you have tremendous competition in radio in Mexico. In Mexico City alone, you have 54 radio stations, and there are 14 different groups that control these radio stations. And competition among broadcasts in the radio market in Mexico is tremendous. You have more radio news shows in Mexico than you have newspapers, and anyone who's been in Mexico City know that's a lot. So it just didn't. The argument just didn't make sense. The electoral reform banned negative campaigns. Why did they ban negative campaigns? Well, one of the reasons is because, you know, some of the people who want to run for president in 2012 do not want to hear negative campaigns. They don't want to be attacked. They just want to have all political advertising be good, and they don't want to be questioned about their transparency, their cleanliness, whether they've been involved or not in corruption. That's basically what they wanted. So one of the issues in this political electoral reform was that negative campaigns were banned, and all other kinds of political advertising were banned as well. So you have no choice right now. You're only going to get good advertising for political candidates, because it was also prohibited that anyone who's not a member, anyone who's not a political party contracting time through the IFE, through the Federal Electoral Institute, could actually place ads in the media. So basically, this means that we're not going to have political questioning, at least not in paid time in the electronic media. The reform also included a compulsory Media Fairness Act, basically a derecho de réplica. Any time you offer a critique of a candidate or of a party, the candidate or the party or anyone in society, there's the law is so wide that anyone can actually demand equal time. And this actually acts as a gag system for the media, because if you question the honesty of a candidate, you can have 10,000 people claiming that they need time, or they want equal time to rebut. And basically, this can turn into a major gag problem for the media in Mexico. And of course, what the electoral reform included was a practical banning of independent candidates. You want to be a candidate for any electoral position in Mexico, you have to go through a party, because there are serious reasons to believe that this might be illegal, because Mexico has signed a series of treaties, international treaties, that provide that Mexico should give anyone, any citizen, the possibility of vying for public office. What the legislators did was very simple. They actually did not ban independent candidates, but they do not give them any money. They do not give them any media time. So if you want to be an independent candidate, fine. You don't get any money, and you don't get any media time, and you're not allowed to contract time with your own money. So it's very simple. It's like having Ross Perot allowed to compete, but not being allowed to buy any media time, which is probably very fair. These are the items that the reform did include. And we can, of course, start talking about all of these things. I believe this reform is a serious step backwards in the democratization of Mexico. I believe this reform responds to the specific needs of a very small group of political leaders in Mexico. And I'm going to name names, specifically Mario Fabio Beltrones, who wants to be president, but who didn't have money. He's not a governor. Governors now have all the money. So he didn't have money, and he's not telegenic, and he has a very shady past that he doesn't want anyone to discuss. So he basically arranged the legislation so as to serve his own purposes. And it is a pity, in fact, and this is my personal opinion, it is a pity that if we had a series of electoral reforms that actually promoted the opening of the system and promoted the democratization of the Mexican system, now we have a legislation that it doesn't destroy Mexican democracy, clearly, but it's a serious step backwards. Thank you.
Sergio, thank you very much, and thanks for holding it back and not being... I think you were bolder than I figured you would be. But that's great for this session. Jeff.
Okay, thank you. Thank you again for the invitation, Armand and Peter. It's great to be back. It's nice to be here this year instead of last year when we didn't have any electricity and we were freezing to death in the hotels. I agree that this is a major counter-reform. I think that, especially in terms of the organization of the IFE and the influence that the consejeros would have in the IFE, the Consejo General, I think we're really pushing it back to about the spring of 94, to those reforms. And so it's going, you know, this is very much a counter-reform. I think we're moving backwards in terms of electoral transparency. I agree with everything that Sergio has to say about freedom of speech and those issues. I'm going to stay off of that for now because I've been ranting all the time at ITAM about freedom of speech. In fact, looking at this reform, I have only one good thing to say about it. I'll say it at the very end. I was very disappointed at what came out, and I'm very concerned about how this will affect elections in the future. This reform weakens the rights of party members versus their parties. The TRIFE, the electoral court, can no longer hear cases until a plaintiff has exhausted all internal appeals. These plaintiffs are usually candidates who have lost in internal processes or something like that, claiming fraud against their own parties. If they have to exhaust all the internal appeals, that would actually then often be just too late. You know, the registration period would have already ended, and the TRIFE would have actually no time. So the parties now have incentives to make very difficult appeals processes to make sure that the candidates don't get to the TRIFE. The parties have been complaining that the TRIFE has been intervening too much in their internal processes. They have a point in some respects, if the parties are gonna, if parties run democratic campaigns, especially transparently democratic campaigns instead of some of the mischief they've been doing for electing candidates, they wouldn't have that much of a problem. I don't think that the TRIFE would likely overturn a lot of cases of truly elected candidates in primaries. And so this actually weakens the rights of the party members, and that's not generally a good thing. It limits the power of the TRIFE to nullify elections. If this is important actually in state elections more than federal elections. If the state law does not provide for nullification, then the trefe cannot nullify. It has to actually follow the rules of nullification of the states, if regardless of the level of fraud or coercion or the lack of equity in the state election. There can be no more causal abstracta, which is what they were using in the past. The trefe interpreted Article 41 of the Constitution, which talks about electoral rights and all those things and how elections should be, and to overturn elections that they felt, you know, the governor, for example, had invented too much influence in the election, or there was major levels of fraud. They overturned elections in states that didn't actually provide for elections to be nullified. Now they cannot do that. The reform does do one thing here for the first time. It actually provides for the nullification of the presidential election, which could be a good thing, or depends. it also asks the states to put in, to specify the rules for nullification. It doesn't actually require them, though, to say that they have to have rules to nullify. It just says that they have to make it more clear during the process. So I think we'll see, obviously fewer elections being overturned now by the trefe, and this gives, a greener light at least to certain parties to commit more fraud. The trefe itself is now under the gun, just like the consejeros were. They had the consejeros hanging actually for the last several months. They didn't know who was going to get fired. The only one who knew for sure was Luis Carlos, and when they didn't name his successor, he left anyway. But the other consejeros didn't know, who was going to get fired, in the change that happened last week. And this actually was happening at the time when the consejeros were, discussing issues of, how to, to do more investigations into the spots, the mysterious spots that we didn't know who paid for. And it turns out they had to just kind of drop it all together. And so to prevent them from making, tough decisions, I think that's part of the reason why we saw part of this delay. The trefe is also under the gun now. The constitutional reform calls for the replacement of the judges and a staggered appointment of the judges of the trefe. That'll happen when the statute is reformed. The statute hasn't been reformed yet, and they're waiting for the statute to get reformed. And so they're going to be behaving themselves from now until the Congress decides to reform the statute of the trefe. And so I think we'll see, fewer cases where the trefe gets involved in controversial issues, especially against the parties that are going to be most influential in reforming this law, and we know who those are. It weakens the IFE. These reforms weaken the IFE against the parties. It allows for less intervention in internal party affairs. The review of the party accounts and of campaign expenditures will not be done by the consejeros, who have often been crusaders on this issue, but by an autonomous office within the IFE. And there are no consejeros that are going to be on a committee to oversee this office. This is the new fiscalization office, and or the party auditing office, or something like that. They won't be able to oversee it as well as they had in the past, and so we won't see crusading consejeros, going after the parties for overspending or things like that. Would be bureaucrats now in the IFE. The parties, of course, didn't like the crusaders, but I think, having crusaders in that issue is not a bad thing. The comptroller of the IFE, the one who's, the internal auditor, is now going to be named by the chamber deputies. And he has the power to sanction the consejeros, but he's not allowed to fire them or to suspend them. This actually means he can fine them or other lower levels of sanctions. There are some arguments that, in the past the IFE named their own comptroller, and the president of the IFE named his own comptroller. This is a little bit different from the rest of the bureaucracy in Mexico these days, where Función Pública is naming the comptrollers to the, or at least initialing them all. to all of the to the second to each of the departments and agencies. There's a good reason to say that, you know, the comptroller should be named by someone from the outside, but it's actually not a good thing to say that, you know, it's not a good thing that it's the Chamber of Deputies that is doing it, because the Chamber of Deputies are the parties. And so now the parties are going to be controlling the comptroller of the IFE, and so if the consejeros get out of line on party decisions or electoral decisions, they can sanction them by doing this. One of the reasons that they can get sanctioned, one of the reasons that the consejeros can get sanctioned now is by inmiscuyéndose, I mean, getting involved in areas that are not of their competence, which means anything below them in the IFE. And so it's actually a very dangerous, you know, they change some of the rules here that make it very dangerous, and it allows the Chamber of Deputies to control the behavior of the consejeros within the IFE itself. The president of the IFE can now be reelected. This means that the parties in the Chamber of Deputies can reward or punish him according to his performance. There's obviously some advantages of, you know, renaming consejeros or the president of the IFE because they're experts. And some of the better candidates in this last round for the IFE were former consejeros. But there is a good argument that you know, they should only have one fixed long term to prevent them from just behaving in ways that will get themselves reelected. It's not like Congress, where we want them to behave the way that voters want. But we don't necessarily want consejeros or the IFE to be behaving in a way that the parties want. This reform also weakens the Consejo General of the IFE, the consejeros, the eight consejeros, and the president to some degree, but especially the eight, versus the IFE bureaucracy. It severely weakens the committees. Allows, in the past, we had the kind of dual leadership in each of the sections of the IFE, each of the sub-bureaucracies, in which there was a director who was part of the IFE bureaucracy and a consejero who was the president of the commission of the committee that oversaw the work that was happening in that agent in that part of the bureaucracy. And so it's a sort of like a parliamentary system in some ways. Like we see in parliamentary systems, we have an elected, you know, a minister that comes out of the parliament in a sense, and then a permanent bureaucrat. This actually made sure that the Consejo, you know, was overseeing everything that was going on and correcting problems from the old IFE. Much of the IFE that exists today is still the IFE that was appointed back in the early 1990s, when the IFE itself wasn't that democratic. And so it's always been very important to have the consejeros participate directly in the decisions and overseeing at a very close level for long periods of time, for their whole 7 years that they've been in as consejeros, overseeing the same bureaucrats. That's changed now. Now the committees have 3-year terms. You cannot sit on a committee for more than 3 years of the 9 years that you're going to be on the consejo. They rotate the chairs annually. Which means that, you know, there is no expert who's going to know, you know, the affairs of this area very well. They're going to be changing all the time. In the past, the secretario técnico, the person who would write up all of the decisions and the resolutions of the committees, used to be the top bureaucrat, and now it's only going to be one of the staff members. They're not allowed to actually make more staff for this position. You know, they've been strong restrictions on the committee's structure. A member cannot be more than, one of the consejeros cannot be on more than two committees. Given that there's six committees, the math doesn't work out. That should be 6 times 3 is 18, and there's only 8 consejeros, 8 times 2 is 16. And so I don't know what's going to happen with the other ones. Unless they actually plan to have the president of the IFE to be on these committees, which was something that they avoided from the very beginning. It was not allowed in the previous COFIPE. Now there can only be 6 committees. They cannot create new committees. These are some of the same committees that we've seen before, though. The one that has to do with choosing the mesas directivas during the election, the people in the precinct, electoral organization, the professional service of the IFE, the civil service of the IFE, the one that works on prerogatives and the political parties, the Registro Federal, the electoral lists, and a new one called Quejas y Denuncias, which is the complaints of the against the parties, usually during campaigns, usually on campaign behavior. During election years, the two most sensitive of these is our electoral organization and Capacitación Electoral, which is the one that names the people to the mesas. These are the most sensitive ones. These are the ones that have been most questioned, that these are old priestas that are running it. And it was it's always been very important to have, you know, the presence of the consejeros overseeing this and correcting problems during the time. These two are now going to be consolidated into just one committee, and it looks like it's going to be halved, and it could actually be that the members are going to be renamed. And so the two most sensitive and vulnerable parts, the committees that, right, the two committees that cover the two most sensitive and vulnerable parts of the IFE are now going to be weakened and combined into just one, which isn't at all a good idea. The IFE, as you may know, has a very strong, huge, decentralized bureaucracy. Each of the states has a large number of members of the IFE working there. Each of the districts has five permanent bureaucrats working there. That hasn't been reduced. There's been many opportunities to reduce this, but the fact that this wasn't reduced means that this was a reform really for the IFE bureaucracy and against the IFE consejeros. Now, the district and local IFE offices, I don't understand exactly what they mean by this, but it's part of the reform that they're very proud about. The district and local IFE offices can now attend to complaints against the parties. And so instead of some of the decisions going up to the IFE, to Tlalpan for the decisions, they're going to be decided at the very local level, and that's sometimes at the district level. That, you know, means that some of the decisions will be more expedited, but it doesn't but it probably means also that there'll be less control from the consejeros themselves over the process, and that could be very dangerous. The campaigns have been shortened to 90 days for the presidential races and for governor races, and for 60 days for the midterms at both federal and state levels. Many people have said this was the best thing about the reform. I tend to disagree because we know that when you have very short campaigns, that tends to help the incumbents and people who are well known. Just think about, Barack Obama wouldn't be able to win if the race was just, very, very short in the preliminary thing. They also reduced the time for the pre-campaigns, the primaries, basically, the primary process in each of the parties. This will also, even more so, help the incumbents, because this is where people are very well, certainly not known very well. And only those who are in positions that get them on the TV quite a bit, like governors or certain senators, will have some advantages. All the state elections have been moved to July, except those in federal election years. This right now in Mexico, we have elections, if not every month, every other month. Sometimes there's, midterm elections in a certain state. Sometimes there's a bunch of gubernatorial elections spread out over the whole year. They have now moved all of them to July, which is a major, attack on federalism. There's one exception. During the federal election years, both the presidential year and the midterm year, they don't do that. The parties can still have them at different times. There's no real good reason for that, except that the Estado de Mexico, which is full of priestas, didn't want it. And this was a favor to the state of Mexico to continue to have their elections at different times. The state of Mexico, also has, it's set it up in such a way to make the coattail effect from the gubernatorial race help them on the elections afterwards. And so they just made an exception for one particular, basically for one state, but it affected all the states during that year. Independent candidates are now allowed by the Constitution for federal elections, but they're still expressly prohibited in the COFIPE, and so the electoral code doesn't allow them. It could if they wanted, you know, they could rewrite the COFIPE to allow them. It's now constitutional to do so. But the COFIPE right now expressly prohibits it. As Sergio said, they even if they do exist, they cannot get any money. That's in the Constitution. And the Constitution prohibits independence right now in state elections, which is where it actually matters. We do have some states, like Yucatan, that permits independent candidates. And now they'll have to change their electoral law, and those will be no longer prohibited. There's some new coalition rules which are interesting. They now, instead of voting for example, when López Obrador runs in 2012, which is obviously going to happen, there won't be just one box for him that has the picture of the PRD or the emblems of the PRD and the PT and Convergencia and whatever other parties he invents in the meantime. Now there'll be different boxes, and people can vote for López Obrador as a periodista or as Convergencia or as PT, and they sum up all those numbers. That's this way. The big parties wanted this because they were concerned that the small parties were taking away too much of their vote when they actually do the agreements to put them together. That's not a bad decision in some terms, although as it's been used in state elections, this will tend to increase the number of seats for the largest party and make it more disproportional. So it's not necessarily a good thing. There's a couple of other Easter eggs in the law that had nothing to do with constitutional reform. They're rotten Easter eggs. I just discovered that now to be a member of the mesas in the casillas of one of the to participate in the election in the precinct, you have to be a Mexicano por nacimiento. You cannot be a Mexicano naturalizado, and you cannot be one of the Mexicans who became a U.S. citizen and then had their citizenship restored. These people cannot participate in elections in any form except to vote. I don't know if they've discovered this yet. You know, once the immigrant communities begin to discover these reforms, it's going to be, you know, might be a serious problem. There is no reason to put this in. I have no idea why they did this, but we've seen a number of changes over the last few years to restrict the rights of naturalized Mexicans. I promise one good thing. They reduced the blackout period for polling to 3 days before the election instead of about a week. That's obviously a good thing. I would reduce it further. I think it's reasonable not to have polling during the election day, but I don't see no reason to do it the day before. Our pollsters in Mexico actually turn out to be a little bit better right now than the ones in the United States. And so I think that's, you know, it's not particularly bad. One thing I do have to say, though, afterwards, after all this reform, which I see as a major counter-reform, surprisingly, they chose some pretty good consejeros. I'm really quite pleased with the three that they chose last week. It basically came out of nowhere. You know, I don't think that any of them was a favorite at the time. And they ended up with a relatively good, pretty good decision. I thought that overall they made some pretty good choices there. So thank you.
Jeff, thank you very much. Raul.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for your invitation, Armand. Good morning, everyone. And I want to make my presentation in two parts. First of all, I want to put on the table seven aspects that I think are very relevant topics in this of this recent electoral reform in Mexico. After that, I would like to put five questions on the table for discussing with our colleagues these questions. I disagree in some aspects, especially with my good friend Sergio Sarmiento, and I agree in some topics, but I substantially disagree. I would say why. No. Well, first of all, I think this recent electoral reform is one of the most complicated, complex process of a political negotiation that we have seen in Mexico the last years. I think this reform has come to fill a tremendous gap, a vacuum that had to be filled last sexenio, the Fox, during the Fox administration. We didn't have in Mexico a federal election over the last 20 years, I think, or more, 30 years, without having before an electoral reform. From 77, as Sergio said, to 2000, we had an electoral reform. But the midterm election in 2003 and the presidential election was were both the only federal elections in 30 years without a previous electoral reform. So this is very important because what the left was demanding, and a good part of the PRI was demanding after the alternation in presidential in presidential power, was precisely that for we the Mexican to consolidate democracy, we needed a state reform, which implies a process of political negotiations with all the actors involved in the political arena. And that was that we don't we didn't have that between 2000 and 2006. But it's very clear that from a political point of view, Vicente Fox has been charged with this lack of ability, capacity to put in motion this process of political negotiation. So this is what means the state reform. This is a very important point because we have to understand that in Mexico we cannot have in these years a constitutional assembly as we have seen that other Latin American countries have had, for example, Ecuador or even Venezuela, Bolivia. So what the politicians in Mexico try to do is to build a kind of, I would say, a semi-constitutional assembly, a small but very representative committee or commission, which is the Comisión Ejecutiva para la Construcción y Negociación de Acuerdos, a kind of executive commission for negotiating and constructing or building political consensus between the political parties, the leader, political leaders in Mexico, and I believe that this includes indirectly to the social actors, the media owners, the people, media leaders, and other social actors. This executive commission was based on a specific law named the Law for State Reform, and this set the methodology that the President Calderón was necessarily President Calderón necessarily agreed with this this law, and then that based on that law, the Executive Commission started to work from April last year, 2007, until the electoral reform was concluded. But let me tell you that that commission is still working, because state reform for the Mexican political context in these recent years implies also four other topics. One is federalism, the other is social rights, the reform on the regarding the political regime, which is especially the government system, the relationship between the president and Congress, and the judicial power. That's the other topic, the reform, the justice reform. And, well, what we have as a result of this important, very complicated and very sensitive process of political negotiation is a reform which covers especially seven aspects, I think. One is the relation between money and money and politics. We have changed substantially the rules. Elections will be cheaper, indeed. We know that we have in Mexico one of the more expensive political and electoral systems in the world. There is some changes in the formula to calculate the public subsidy to the political parties. Second is the relation between media and parties. As Sergio said, the IFE has now the exclusive power to contract or the electronic media airtime for political campaigning. It is true that other persons, private people, has been forbidden to contract airtime in radio and television, not in newspapers, not in other kind of electronic, even electronic media, for example, internet, or for example, the telephone messages, or this kind of other modern technologies, just radio and television airtime. And this, of course, is very sensitive. We can discuss this, at least I can discuss it in constitutional terms, because this has been challenged before the federal judicial power, and we have waiting for the final decision, especially from the Supreme Court, if the Supreme Court holds these challenges presented by intellectuals and different people, in private people in Mexico. The third is the party rules. There are a lot of changes in the party rules. For example, the political parties will have much more duties. They have been obligated to inform to the transparency. There is a new chapter in the Federal Electoral Code for this purpose. And we have to wait to the secondary and specific regulations, because they are on the making. There are 18 secondary laws and regulations that are on the making. They have to be elaborated by the chamber of by the Congress over the next 6 months before July, I think. So 90 days before the 2008 to 2009 federal electoral process begins. No, we have to have these 18 laws before the new electoral process begins. For example, it is true that political parties will have the monopoly to nominate candidates. And so the independent candidates are prohibited. That's true. But we have to discuss why. Why, if, for example, Yucatan established 2 years ago that independent candidates were legal, and the Supreme Court says, well, independent candidates are not valid or constitutional for federal effects, no? So another thing is that a fourth topic I think is that we have a new campaign rules. As Jeffrey said, we have now in the law, not as a judicial or jurisprudence creation, we have in the law new rules for pre-campaigning, no? The primaries, or, and that is also a new an innovation in Mexican electoral law. Another point, the fifth point is that we have a new regulation with new and explicit responsibilities for social and political actors. This is a new book or new chapter in the Federal Electoral Code, which means that media and, for example, the church people, the clergymen, no, and others, the government employees, the electoral officials, they are going to, they are forbidden to intervene in electoral process in some ways. And this is because over the last at least 6 to 10 years, former federal elections, we saw people acting, behaving with all responsibility. In the media, for example, Sergio is one of them, a very intellectual, careful commentator, but not all the media commentators are responsible. They are very much on the contrary. They give very light opinions. They confuse the public opinion. They assume they are the public opinions, and they are just public commentators. They participate and intervene in the electoral process, but they don't have any responsibility. So the politicians, the political point of view, not the intellectual, not the academic, but the political point of view, who has to be justified in constitutional terms, no? It's important, they thought that this had to change, and they changed it, of course, because they felt that there has had been in Mexico an abuse by the media regarding the political electoral process without responsibility. So we, from the intellectual and academic point of view, we have been working on a new electoral theory that includes social actors, like especially the media, into the electoral process. So this is a very sensitive point. We can discuss this further later. The sixth point, I think, is electoral federalism, because an article of the Constitution, federal constitutions, mandates that over the next year, a lot of all these principles and changes that the legislators and put on the federal constitution, they have to be assumed by the local constitutions, and they have to develop this at the local level. So there going to be a realignment of the electoral calendars, federal and local. Especially the local calendar has to be consistent, coherent with the federal elections. We, in the long term, we will have in Mexico just two Super Sundays, no? The 2nd of July, the year of presidential election, and the other one will be, I think, in the midterm, 3 years after the presidential election, we have the second Super Sunday. Because if we change the relation between media and parties and money and politics, I think we have to change also the campaigning rules, the access to media, and then we will have over the long term, in the long term, a more, I think, I don't know, more political debate in media, managed by that the airtime managed by the electoral authorities, not by private interest, especially specific groups with strong interest around the electoral process, as we saw the last presidential election with the Coparmex issue, no? So this put in risk not only the electoral process, but also Mexico's political stability. So from a political, I stress the political aspect of this, the political point of view, political actors' point of view in Mexico, this is not possible. Of course, President Calderon agrees absolutely with this electoral reform, because his political representatives are in forming part of the executive commission for negotiating and constructing this electoral reform. Well, I have to put on the table two or three, I said five, well, issues or questions that I would like especially to discuss here. For example, if the prohibition to buy airtime in radio and television violates the freedom of expression in Mexico. But a group of intellectuals and other the Coparmex and other private persons, people, challenge before the federal judicial power the electoral reform in this aspect, because of what Sergio mentioned before, which was that there is a kind of restriction, no, limitation to the freedom of freedom of speech, because some people, private people, cannot buy radio and television airtime to influence the electoral behavior, the people's electoral behavior. So I defend that this is constitutional. Let me put on the table why, my reasons. Because this limitation is consistent with the two another constitutional principles. This is a matter of evaluating constitutional principles. According to this new model of political communication, the new relation between media and political parties, and federal electoral authorities, we have to safeguard the two principles, the principle of electoral legality and electoral equity, which is now, according to this recent electoral reform in the Article 134 of the Constitution. We have five principles, constitutional electoral principles in Mexico before this election. Which are in Article 41 of the Constitution. But after this recent electoral reform, we have six. And the six is very important because that was one of the main demands and claimings of López Obrador, the left, and part of the PRI, and other political parties, which was the equity. The principle of equity. So we have that principle, and I think their limitation just in one part of the freedom of speech is consistent with the new principles and political communication model that has resulted from this recent electoral reform. Second point that I think is important, because this is the Jorge Castañeda issue that is discussing right now at the level of Inter-American Justice Court, is if it whether or not it's constitutional in Mexican institutional framework and constitutional terms that we forbid the independent candidates. This is important to discuss if we are violating or not international human rights law or not. I defend, at least if my opinion is relevant, I defend that is constitutional. We have studied this very carefully, and I see that in the American Convention, the national states have the power to establish modalities for the independent candidates. So I think this can be discussed further. Another controversial topic is what Jeffrey mentioned. Did electoral reform reduce Federal Electoral Institute autonomy before the political parties and especially the Chamber of Deputies or not? I think what we have now is a new balancing, a new equilibrium, a new check and balances between the Chamber of Deputies, the Federal Electoral Institute, and political parties. And even the bureaucracy, internal bureaucracy of the IFE, which is a political actor itself. It's a very strong, it's a civil, Servicio Civil de Carrera, no? I think this we can discuss this, and other point that we can discuss further is if why the president of the IFE, the counselor of the Consejo General, has been appointed for 6 years, not 9, 6, and the rest of the counselors have been appointed, and they are going to be renewed 9 to 9 years in parts. 3 counselors in 9 years, and another 3 another 9. But why the president of the General Council is going to be renewed in 6 years, or why is he to be? Why can he be reelected or ratified by the chamber. And I think that is because we don't want in Mexico, or at least the people who decided this, to have a new situation like we had in 2006 and 2007, precisely with our friend Luis Carlos Ugalde. Because we cannot have a president that behaves very well in technical standards, but in the political context and the political criteria in Mexico, he has been delegitimated by the political actors, and there is a very complex situation where the very institution, the IFE in this case, is the losing position, and I think this is the reason why. For example, the electoral court and the electoral commission in Panama, no, they have the electoral commission and the electoral tribunal in Panama, they are the same. Just one institution organizes the election, and the same institutions resolve the challenge, the judicial challenge to the election. These guys, they are three members of this institution. They have more than one decade. I think 2 decades since Noriega, now, organizing election. But let me tell you that each election, they have alternates in the presidency, and they didn't have the problem that we have in Mexico in 2006. I know that the result, the close result, is not a reason to change the members of the electoral commission. But if we have this political, very complex political situation that we have with the president and the councillors 2006-2007, is very complicated. Everyone loses. No? So we need to prevent this hypothesis. And that's the reason, I think, why the president is nominated for 6 years. So I am concluding. Just one additional word. There are important new provisions in this electoral reform. For example, all the elections, we saw this in Cancun last week, all the elections, federal and local elections, are going to be or can be recounted. All the ballots in every election. So we have to avoid what we had in Mexico in 2006 with the phenomenon of López Obrador. So I think the politicians in Mexico, and in that point I cordially disagree with Sergio, they made a very thinkable, very careful effort to and a very complex political negotiation to prevent and to regulate these problems that we had in Mexico in 2006. Thank you.
Todd, why don't you start off? Because I know we don't have a lot of time, and I'd like to bring people to the discussion and give also Sergio and Jeff an opportunity to comment. But go right ahead.
Is really a counter-reform. I also agree that without a doubt, the sort of cutting the autonomy of the IFE and also of the Electoral Tribunal, and to some extent reversing the constitutional reach of the Electoral Tribunal is also a big step backwards. And I, having studied these institutions for a long time, I feel very strongly in agreement with Dr. Weldon on that. But I do want to raise one other question, which I think there's a tension between Professor Avila and the other two speakers with regard to the issue of equity. And while I want to ask the other two speakers how it could be that even if this new reform did not sufficiently or properly address reducing campaign spending, giving a greater role to aspects in campaigns besides money, how could that have been achieved? Or, you know, and is there any hope to rescue some of this in the supporting laws, which are still to some extent coming forward? It seems that that we have a problem in an effort cast as an effort to bring equity to the electoral law, when in fact I'm not clear that that's going to happen. I'm not so ready to throw in the towel and be as negative about it as perhaps our other speakers, but I want to see if there's any way to reconcile these positions, at least on the issue of party finance and campaign spending.
The new law is not equitable. The new law actually creates more differences in parties because it puts, by reducing the amount of money expended,
right,
period, and by decreasing the amount of private funding that can go into the campaigns, small parties cannot now compete directly with the big parties, period. And so it's actually less equitable than it was before. I think it's important. This is not something new with the law. It's new that it's in the Constitution to some degree. It is important that there are, you know, more strict restrictions on public officials using public funds for campaigns, and that should obviously be avoided. But I see no reason to justify, for the sake of equity, reducing private interests in campaigns. This is really remarkable what we've done in Mexico, and I'm very concerned about the media also on these issues. You know, we have our Rush Limbaughs, but to protect our Sergio Sarmientos, we have to also protect the Rush Limbaughs. There's no way you can protect one without protecting the other, and so I think that I would not put equity as actually at the top of the list. I would certainly say that you know, freedom of speech is we have freedom of speech not for arts. You know, that's what their argument is about in Mexico. We're not touching a lot of those things, and you know, we have freedom of speech as a basic fundamental right for political reasons, and to cut that out from the very beginning to say that's the particular political speech, that's a particular speech that we're going to prohibit, is really quite remarkable. And so I would say that, you know, equity is not a major issue there for me.
I said at the end of my presentation that I didn't think this reform is a tragedy for Mexico. It's not that democracy is disappearing. Democracy will persist. It is a step backwards, and I'm going to point at try to rebut some of the arguments of Raúl Ávila. In fact, I was going to say I did point out there were some good things about the reform. The fact that there are restrictions on support of established governments of certain political candidates, I think it's a good thing. So Jeff mentioned it, and again the elimination or the reduction of the restriction on public opinion polls, that's another good point. There are good points, but the key issues here are the ones that I'm going to try to address. First of all, this idea that the reform reduces campaign spending is a fallacy. It doesn't reduce campaign spending. Basically, what it does is it confiscates time in the media without indemnization in order to generate the idea that you're reducing campaign spending. But if you actually take a look at the amount of money the political parties have to spend per day of campaign, they actually increase that. So they actually increase their own money, and they just confiscated media time in order to have a smaller bill. But that's it. We're not reducing campaign spending. I do have a number of objections to the things that have been to the points that have been pointed out by Raul Avila. I'm not going to demand equal time. I won't take the half hour or so. But basically, yes, President Calderon agreed with the law. I have never argued that the fact that presidents agree or disagree with the law is good or bad. I mean, the laws are good or laws are bad, regardless of whether presidents agree with the law or not. The fact that there's a commission working and continuing the reform of the state, my opinion continues to show that the political elite of the country, the political system of the country, is trying to look for ways to take away from the people, take away from the media, take away from independent people the control over the political system of the country. They felt that with the 1996 campaign, the society took the control over the process from them, so they're trying to fight back. Probably inevitable. I do believe we, society, have a right to fight back. By the way, I'm one of the people, so-called intellectuals. I don't consider myself an intellectual, but I'm one of the people who sued the government on because I believe this law is unconstitutional. I believe we're going to lose the process, of course, but that's because of a technical reason. Our amparo legislation says that for you to be successful, you have to prove that a law is against the Constitution. That's why they changed the Constitution, so they'll make it constitutional. And now the big issue with the Supreme Court, and it's a major issue. It's in fact, it's probably more important than the issue that we're talking about here, which is electoral reform, is whether Congress can amend the Constitution so as to eliminate fundamental rights. I mean, do we want a Congress that will strip rights from Jews and blacks or Americans living in Mexico just because that's included in the Constitution? One of the reasons why they changed the Constitution in such detail, for example, Article 41 of the new Constitution, tells you exactly how many minutes you can advertise in political, if you're a political party, how many minutes you can use of media time. That's not included in any constitution in the world. The way they did it that way is to prevent precisely prevent people like me to actually sue them and claim that the law is unconstitutional. Raul Avila says, we have changed the relationship between money and politics. Elections will be cheaper. No, I don't think they will be cheaper. In fact, you're creating a number of, first of all, political parties have a lot more money. I don't believe with enough transparency. And before that, 90%, 80% of the money they had was being used for the media, which is actually quite transparent. You can always see the ad on television or hear the ad in radio. But now we're not going to know what they're doing, what they're using their money for. We have 280,000 TV and radio spots that no one claims. We know they were aired because we could see them and we could hear them. What's going to happen now that the parties are going to have more money, but they're going to use them for things that we can't see? We're going to see a lot of dirty money. I can assure you that elections are not going to be cheaper. They just simply money is going to be diverted in a different way. This issue, and Raul Avila was saying, we're not censoring newspapers or the internet. We're merely censoring the media, the radio and television. They're the bad ones. Actually, the law says that any shape of radio or television will be censored. The internet has written materials and has audio materials and has video materials. Eventually, they're going to have to come up with the conclusion that in the modern world, you can't separate the media. They're all together in the internet. Eventually, they're going to be compelled to censor the internet. And the way the way this has been written, you can't tell whether Mexico is going to join China and Burma as among the countries that censor the internet, or we're going to remain a free country in the internet. Mr. Avila defends the monopoly of parties to nominate candidates. He claims that part of the problem is that there are some political actors, some social actors that are irresponsible. It is not you, Sergio. You're a very responsible person, but there's always someone who says things that are not responsible, and we want to make them be responsible. But that's how censorship is born everywhere in the world. There's someone whose positions I don't agree with, and therefore he is not responsible, and thus I'm going to censor this person. Why aren't private individuals allowed to advertise politically? Why, if there's a debate in the country about abortion, why only political candidates can debate about it? Why can't I put an ad in the radio saying the position of this candidate is wrong? I'm for abortion, or I'm against abortion, whatever position, but why shouldn't I be allowed to do that? Why should political discussion be the preserve of the political parties? That's the issue in this political reform. And I have a huge slate of other things. I just don't want to monopolize the microphone. But these are some of the issues that I believe we should be discussing right now.
Sydney.
I'd like the point about Calderon. You all agreed that he agreed with it. Why did he agree with it? That's the question I've had since the beginning.
I can tell you that he actually exchanged the electoral reform for the fiscal reform. It's just very simple. He needed money, and the only way he would get the votes from the PRI, from the PRI, for his fiscal reform is that if he agreed with the electoral reform. It was just very simple. It was quite open, and I can tell you, you know, it's not speculation. This is exactly what happened. He accepted the electoral reform. It's a reform that, if the rules that we now have had been in place in 2005, 2006, he wouldn't be president of Mexico. It's just as simple as that. But he needed the reform, the fiscal reform, for money, and that's basically what he got.
Okay, that's what I thought, but I couldn't believe it.
It's very clear. You know, I can tell you, there's no doubt about it. It's okay. Not speculation.
Thank you.
Mario Mitre, National Democratic Institute. One of the things that, since the beginning of the new IFE, was very clear is that the impartiality, or the perception of impartiality of the council, was very important to make this institution work. So Jose Waldenberg and the people that served with him were very important to the process and to make the institution credible. With the election of Ugalde, since he was elected, there was a cry from the PRD that he was elected by Joseph Priendepan. So there was that seed that kind of exploded or germinated in 2006. So I think my question now is, it's very hard to find an individual like Jose Waldenberg to serve as president every single time, and councillors that are palatable to all political parties are credible every single time. So how do you shield or protect the institution for the long run, realizing that parties are going to be involved in the election of these people, that process is not always going to be smooth, and that at the same time kind of protects the electoral process?
We should distinguish between published opinion and public opinion. The IFE had a 70% trust rate, according to public opinion polls, with Luis Carlos Ugalde. The confidence on IFE did not diminish with the transition between Jose Waldenberg and Luis Carlos Ugalde. It might have diminished in the eyes of certain political groups. Manlio Fabio Beltrones, the senator, always accused him of being a puppet of El Bester Gordillo, but never presented any arguments. And the PRD always rejected the legality of all of them, but that was part of a political strategy, so that they could claim that if they won the election, they wanted in spite of the IFE, and if they lost it, it was that they lost it because of the IFE. Even after the 2006 elections, in which Andrés Manuel got 30% of the vote and harped against the IFE. They only managed to reduce the confidence rate on the IFE from 70% to 60%, which is quite remarkable considering the airtime that López Obrador got. So the IFE had really the trust of the people. And if we were to change the IFE every time popularity declines, by the way, we should be getting rid of Congress. Congress has a trust rate right now of about 20%, so we should be getting rid of Congress altogether and not of the IFE. But the point here is that the IFE has proved that it can work well, and as Jeff said, I'm also, you know, the IFE's structure, it's highly bureaucratic, whatever, but it's a very professional structure, and it works well. It has the confidence of people. Luis Carlos Ugalde always kept, most people didn't even know who Luis Carlos Ugalde was, but they trusted the IFE. So it was not an issue of confidence. It was also pointed out by Raúl Ávila. No one ever lost confidence of the IFE except for the politicians who want to get rid of them. And I do think it's, if you're going to maintain the confidence of an institution, the least thing you can do is get rid of the referees if you don't like their decisions. If in football you were getting rid of the referees because they made either the wrong decision or they made a decision that you do not agree with, then you're going to destroy the credibility of the referees. But not if you just keep a system that works. But clearly, if they had not lost the public trusts, it had lost the trust of certain politicians.
This is an opinion. I think the new law has really atomized the executive taking of decisions inside the whole system. And the society, which always has had trouble reaching a yes or no or maybe or otherwise decision, I think this is going to create power vacuums, or enormous vacuums. My question really is, what will be the role of the Interior Minister and the Interior Ministry in a situation like this?
Almost all the decisions in July before the election where the PRD was complaining against the other parties, the PRD won in the IFE. It was the PAN that was pretty upset about the decisions of the IFE from the year preceding the election. After the election, you know, the results came out badly for López Obrador and he blamed the IFE for it. But he actually had no particularly good grounds on pre-electoral decisions and whatever happened during the process. I mean, the fact that they didn't even announce the results right away, you know, hurt the PAN a lot more than it hurt the PRD in many ways. There are a lot of political, you know, errors, I think, by Luis Carlos, particularly the day of the election, that where he should have made a different decision. But those are mostly just questions of social communication, not questions of, and certainly not questions of equity. And if there was an equitable, you know, this balance was mostly in favor of the PRD during the election. Most of the divided votes were actually between the PRI and the PAN, those factions. And in those cases, most of the time, Luis Carlos was with the PRI, because they're the ones who named it. On the issue of Gobernación has been removed, you know, basically from the process since 96. They're going to continue to be removed. There might be changes now that'll put Gobernación back into the process in surprising ways that have to do with the changes in the Ley de Medios, you know, the way they're going to be the derecho de réplica, these fairness doctrine questions are perhaps going to be adjudicated by Gobernación, and so it'll politicize Gobernación a little bit more, and something that they've been kind of keeping out of for some time. But they will continue to stay out of the process of the IFE, and that's actually a good thing. That was a major change that I think was a good change. But that, I think that's a, you know, I think it's probably good to keep Gobernación out.
I know we're almost running out of time. You had one question. If you can make it very brief, and then I have, I'm going to take the advantage of the fact that I'm running the show to ask one last question. Please.
Thank you very much. I would like to know if we could make a generalization on the public opinion reaction to the actual reform. Is there a sense, as you mentioned, that the reform favors particular people instead of the process in itself? And in that regard, tied up, is this IFE ready for another close election in the future in terms of the perception in the people that it would render a legitimate legal resort? Or are we facing, well, I want to keep on.
Well, the first of all, is the reform popular? There were a number of public opinion polls after the reform was made that showed that the reform was not popular. It's hard to tell whether this is a consequence of whether people understood the reform or whether because the media actually dissuaded people. The media were very upset with the reform, and they made it very clear. But the one or two public opinion polls that I saw showed that the reform was quite unpopular. Is the IFE ready for another close election? It depends on who wins. Jose Woldenberg was very, very lucky that Vicente Fox won the election. Remember that one day before the election, both Vicente Fox and Jorge Castañeda claimed that the PRI was going to steal the election. And they had all, you know, they had a campaign ready to be mounted if Fox lost the election. If in 2012 the PRD wins, it doesn't matter how close the election is, it's going to be a great election. And Mr. Leonardo Valdez is going to be remembered as a very good president of IFE. If either the PRI or the PAN win, then it's going to be, regardless of the distance, it's going to be a dirty election that was manipulated. Those seem to be the rules of the game in Mexico right now. Only if the politically correct candidate wins, then you get a clean election.
You know, Jeff mentioned it in one of his answers. You know, it's not too long ago that the Ministry of Government or the Ministry of the Interior actually ran the elections. You go back to 1994, and it was Arturo Núñez who presided over the administration of the election. We then went to 1996 reforms with a much more independent IFE, a much more independent tribunal. If you look at the big picture, I think it's only natural that the political parties who went, at least from a political party in power, who actually ran the elections to then a much more plural system with a much more autonomy in the institutions, I actually think it's only natural that the political parties would push back as a result of their displeasure over having lost some of the control. So I don't see the reform as surprising. I'm surprised that there wasn't much more of an uproar in Mexican society. I'm afraid that the role of the media and the role of Coparmex in particular diminished the impact that the media could have otherwise played, because in the eyes of the Mexican people, I think the media and the Coparmex in particular were perceived to have been complicitous in the election outcome. And so you had the conditions set up, unfortunately, for an effective pushback from the parties without having a credible voice articulating the opposition to that reform. My question is, having said that, and having the reform limit public expression, what is the future? What is the future for electoral reform in Mexico? When will we see those conditions created again whereby you have an electoral process that is more representative of the people? Sergio started off with a comment which I think was, you know, I think it was the comment, and that is, here you have a reform that bypassed re-election, that would have at least given that level or degree of representative to the Mexican legislature, and you don't have that. So I don't know, I'm not that optimistic. It is a step back. It's not the end of Mexican electoral democracy, but it is, I think, to me, it is a step back that is concerning, given that the limitations that this reform has, I think, makes it difficult for those conditions to be created again for there to be another electoral reform, unless it just electoral reforms become the subject of political horse trading, which is the point that you made. The other is, here you have a Mexico where there's a segment of the Mexican population that feels unrepresented, i.e. the left, and the radical left that even feels less represented, and I'm just wondering whether this electoral reform could have implications for increased radicalization in Mexico.
I think we have to remember why we had the previous electoral reforms. The electoral reform of 94, for example, was due specifically to the Zapatistas and to the requirement then of the pre-giving up a little bit more power to a more autonomous IFE very quickly, just almost overnight, to make things look more democratic. The 1996 reforms were a direct response to the economic crisis of 95 and a complete lack of confidence in the government. And so we required crises in order to get good reforms. I don't want to wait for another crisis to correct this counter-reform in the future, because crises aren't very good. And I think that it's going to be very hard to turn these things back. I don't see any reason for the parties to want to get rid of the prohibitions on denigration. Why would they want to do that? Why let them attack us? I don't see any reason for the parties to go against any of the other restrictions on freedom of speech and restrictions on the media, because it's the media that attacks these parties. And so I think we're actually going to see, I'm really the most pessimistic here. I think that we'll actually see a significant decrease in quality of democracy in Mexico, because there will not be debate. There will not be questions of civilized debate in the media, in the, or outside of the media. And I think we're going to be left with much probably more radicalized forms of debate, which
forms
isn't
expression.
Or expression, yeah, right.
Even when you eliminate forms of expression,
when you create the conditions. First of all, about the first thing you said, you're right. The media has been arrogant. The media have been arrogant. The media have irritated the political elite. They felt that they were being blackmailed, and that's why they reacted in such a way to the media. And I will not defend the media in that sense, because the media have been arrogant. And of course, society shouldn't be punished for the media's sins. In my opinion, the 1994 reform, it was a consequence of the Zapatista rebellion, and it was made so that there would be an opening for the left in Mexico. That was the interesting thing about it. It was Carlos Salinas de Gortari and the whole political elite of Mexico. They always thought that the real challenge would come from the left. So they created a system that was actually built to allow the left and Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas and the PRD to take power peacefully. But lo and behold, Vicente Fox and the Panistas won, which is something that no one expected, and thus the rules of the game changed. Is the left going to become radicalized? There's a possibility. It's interesting to see what was the position of Andrés Manuel López Obrador and the part of the PRD that he represents, which is the more radical part of the PRD. He didn't say anything about the reform. While the reform was still not enacted, once the reform was enacted constitutionally, and the councillors, the consejeros, were sacked, that's when he remembered that he didn't like the reform, and then he began to say, "No, the reform is not good." But of course, he waited for the consejeros to be sacked, because this was a personal revenge for him. I want to get rid of Luis Carlos Ugalde and the consejeros because they did me wrong. But after they were sacked, then he decided that that the law was not the problem, and then he, in fact, his deputies, his legislators, voted against the reform, which is something quite. Quite significant. The left is becoming is being fragmented once again. It's happened many times in the past. We're going to see we're seeing an internal process within the PRD right now, in which there's a big fight between the radical left headed by López Obrador and the more moderate left headed by Jesús Ortega. I don't know who's going to win, but the answer to your question is largely going to depend on who becomes. President of the PRD. If it is Jesús Ortega, I think the radical left is going to become even more radicalized. If it is Alejandro Encinas, who represents the PRD, who represents Andrés Manuel López Obrador, I believe Jesús Ortega will accept that decision and will work within the PRD, which is interesting. The future. I think we're going to just go back a little bit, a couple of steps. I believe we're going to have, now a process that tends to favor the incumbent, tends to favor those who have real access to power and money, which are the governors. What we're going to see is more and more elections in Mexico are going to be won by the incumbent, and there's a good chance that the PRI might regain power in 2012 because they have the more states, and thus they have the more power, they have the more money, and the rules have been made for them. So there's a chance, there's a good possibility that this basically means that we're going back to where we were in 1994 with more victories by the PRI. But it is not the end of the democratization of Mexico. There are many people who've bet on changing Mexico, and the struggle is going to continue.
Raúl, I wanted to give you the last word, and I think with that we need to end the session. Okay. But.
I disagree, and I'm going to have to say why. You know, because once you read the law, you realize that's not true. But
media has to wait until the Federal Electoral Institute and political parties
which are represented at the, in the electoral Federal Electoral Institute regulates in detail and make a negotiation with the media before or during the electoral campaigns, before the electoral campaign starts, the terms of the way the media, TV and radio, is going to open and to contract. In fact, they are going to be paid by the IFE, not by the political parties directly, with the media, for those new spaces for political debate. And people coming from different sectors of society, the private sector, the social sector, can propose to the IFE, I think, to the IFE, can they can propose to the IFE to have some spaces in radio and TV for debating political issues. But this is very different to make an interference or intervention, interested intervention, violating the equity principle during the electoral process, as we saw in 2006, and to producing a tremendous pressure, putting a pressure on the electoral institutions and the electoral process. So this is a, as Todd mentioned, I think, a rebalancing, a re-equilibrium, a new check and balances, not only between the formal institutions, but also between formal institutions and informal political actors, which those didn't have until now legal responsibility for doing what they do. No, so I think we are going to see how this works, no? This new equilibrium, check and balances, not only, I insist, between the formal institutions, but also the informal institutions and informal and very powerful social and economic actors. No? We want to see.
We're going to have to end this debate.
Okay. Well, it's just, I'm just saying that it is one of the lies about this is that it ends the sportization of politics. In fact, the Constitution actually bans having anything more than 3 minutes on airtime. It actually bans it. Also, it condenses the sportization.
Well, that wouldn't be tolerated here in Washington. I can tell you that much right now. I want to thank you all, the three of you, for coming up and sharing with us, an informed debate on the electoral reform and its implications. And please join me in thanking our guests, and thank you.